I've introduced the staff. Tonight we've got Bruce Thompson, who's our man on cap, which is really the crown jewel of the whole Part 3 program, isn't it, Bruce?
Oh, absolutely. Also, tutor in life insurance.
And a tutor in life insurance, thank you. Anthony Bryan. Stand up, Anthony. Stand up, see. He's the chief examiner for life insurance. And David Ticehurst hasn't joined us just yet, but he's racing to be here. And then we've got some members of our prize winners panel who you're going to talk to later, who, as I said, will give you the truth about Part 3. You guys are familiar with this, but let me take you through this really quickly. Part 1 is the University Foundation, bachelor's degree. Part 2 has two components, actuarial control cycle and investments. Come up front. Then there's the work experience requirement, PER, and then there's the famous professionalism course. Now, that's the pathway to associateship. Without wanting to complicate things, we are in the process, as many of you would know, of an education strategy review, which is looking at each part of that pathway. You know, for example, we are thinking about the duration of that work experience requirement, whether that should be perhaps 1 year rather than three, and whether we might want to put some teeth into it in terms of supervision and mentoring over that period. We're working with our unis on how Part 2 will be delivered going forward and from a content point of view. So there are going to be some changes, and of course we'll tell the membership about that in the broad, but you're really not going to see anything before 2019-2020. So 2018, we're on this plan. Okay? Now, the pathway to fellow is you do all of that which I've just gone through, and then we add in Part 3, which is the focus of this evening. So Part 3 has got, well, four layers, but really three layers to it. The first layer, Module 1, as you'll see, has you know, a number of options available to you. Modules 2 and 3 together are Part A and B. This is where you do your specialisation, whether that be life or general or otherwise. And then, as I said, the final layer is CAP, you know, the crown jewel in the program, Bruce. We get to do the joy of an 8-hour examination. And that really, you know, the CAP really brings together everything and is demonstrated, really demonstrated to show you how you're actually working in practice, hence the name of the course. Sure, all of that is pretty much known to you. Now, how is Part 3 different from university? Without looking at this slide, which you've all done, anybody have a view on how Part 3 might be different from uni? Not at all? No suggestion? Well, I'll tell you anyway, it's on the slide. It is the case that you take a greater responsibility for learning. There's nobody there telling you to show up to things. There's nobody there monitoring how you're going. There's nobody there tracking how you're progressing towards, you know, preparation for an exam. There's nobody there really telling you to do anything. I know you're all mature members of this industry, but it is quite a difference when you get to Part 3, and I think some people do find that transition on occasion a little difficult. Work-life balance, well, there basically is none. It's all work. Clearly, it is something you're going to have to manage. I assume most of you are employed and you've got a job to do, and then you've got to fit in some fairly tough study requirements at the same time. And it can be taxing. There is certainly some pressure on the individual, both because of this, you don't have supervision and guidance the whole time, hands-on, and you're having to manage that work-life balance. And you'll need to work out a way to cope with that. I guess, you know, less contact in that you're not members, you know, there are tutorials, but you're not frequently part of tutorial groups and probably have a reduced opportunity to form relationships with other students as you have at university. Open book exams, well, that certainly doesn't mean they're easy, does it, Anthony? And then we are looking, this is very much, it's not about regurgitation of facts. you are all very clever, otherwise you wouldn't have got through the earlier parts of the program, but it's about your ability to make complex judgment decisions, to apply the higher levels of analytical thinking, not simply use tools and show how smart you are. Okay? Any questions on that? Anything you think is wrong there? Okay. So, not all bad, obviously. What can you do? While I said there's less of an opportunity than when you're at uni in the past to form groups and so on, there are opportunities to do that, but really you've got to drive it. Nobody's going to do that for you. You can certainly discuss requirements with your colleagues at work, many of whom will have been through the same courses you're about to do. There's a lot of online support available to you, and I'd urge you to take advantage of that. And we, coming back to my comments about how, not right now, but 2019-2020, we're going to see some transition in the education program. We at the Institute are going to be taking more advantage of online learning tools. Prioritise your tasks and responsibilities and set up a study routine and stick to it. Easier said than done, but that clearly is a way to do it. So who are you all? We've got over 400 enrolments for a semester. We're still counting for this semester, but I'm confident we'll get over that figure. Yes, the general life is still, in terms of representation by practice area, are still dominant, but that dominance is actually skinnying down, and we're starting to see particularly people coming in at the beginning of the pipeline, if you like you, a move into other areas such as data analytics. The 70% spend 11 to 20 hours a week. Now that comes back to that work-life balance. Man, that's a lot, isn't it?
But the other 30% spent more than 20 hours, and they're the ones who pass.
Just tell Bruce you're doing X hours, and then you pass.
That's sure.
And I'll let these guys talk to them, who are very experienced practitioners and teachers in this area. But the average time to complete is around 3 years, so it's not smooth sailing. The pass rates, let me tell you, are somewhat south of 90%. And, we do see people having to make multiple attempts, and that's not because there's limitations, but I think often it's because it's just the amount of work required to actually do the job. The pleasing thing is, and we have a graduation ceremony, which you will all get to participate in, where we put through 60 to 80 new fellows each year, and we celebrate that. Okay. So any questions on any of that? Very quiet tonight. I'd like to now introduce my colleague Eleanor, who is somewhere around here. She's right in front of me. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Hi all. So my name is Eleanor Mazando. I'm the education manager, and we manage the operations of the delivery for part three. It is myself and also Chantafon, who is the education coordinator. So we'll be the two people you must probably deal with the most throughout your studying, along with interaction with some of our volunteers and the people who help deliver the program. So what I'm just going to go through is basically how we deliver the program and some things that you need to be aware of, what's available, where you can find things, and just a bit of background. And then obviously I'll hand over to the people you actually want to hear from, who are our chief examiners, who will give you a bit of background on, from their perspective, what they're looking for and what can assist you during your time, as well as our students here who will give you their take on what they've been through. And I think Tony's already let you know that, they are prize winners, so they have won the prize for being the highest in their subject. And they'll just give you their hints and tips as well. And then at the end of the session, we'll have question and answers, obviously, with all of them. And then we have pizzas coming, which is the most important part. And Tony didn't say anything. But, we will have some food and some drinks, and we can all hang around, and we're all available for any questions afterwards. So the delivery of part three. I assume that most of you are already enrolled, obviously, and that you have received your access to the LMS. So the LMS is the online portal and our main delivery tool for part three. This is where you can access all your course materials, any information on any dates This is the area we also use mainly for communication with students. So we use the forum in there as our main communication tool with students. And anything sort of important around what's happening, you can access it through the LMS. I did an email went out this morning, the welcome that let you know that everyone should be logged in. But if you haven't received your login, please contact the education team and we'll help you out with that. The other thing that we also provide for part three delivery is the tutorial. So this is for the modules 2 and 3, along with, we do have 3 tutorials now introduced as well for ERM. So you have 3 tutorials per semester. There's a schedule available on our website as well as in the LMS, and we will sort of, we just follow the same format. You will come here into the office. It will be available as well for you to access online. And then we do have some of our tutors who are not based in Sydney, and they also sometimes make an office available in Melbourne or wherever they're based. But we will definitely put up all the information for you in the LMS so that you know where you can attend that tutorial. The website as well is a place where you can access any information, all the past exams, assignments, the BOE reports go up there. The BOE report for last semester will be going up next week, so we will also put a forum post once that's all available for you, and you can access that on the website. That's just a picture there of the LMS and just a guidance around where everything is. The discussion forum is also available for you in the LMS, but I'll give you a little more detail on that shortly. So some part three policies and procedures that are available for you to take advantage of. First of all, we ask you all to read the Code of Professional Conduct. The PS1, this is available on our website. It's also available in the LMS, and obviously that's just around the conduct that we expect from people in this profession and, academic honesty, that sort of thing, which the chief examiners here will speak a little bit more to. But that's just some background information on just the expectations of the profession. Around enrollment, we have a few things available. So for those of you who are enrolled who maybe are not 100% sure if you're going to make it through the semester, we know that work comes up and things change and you might need to withdraw. There are forms available on our website for withdrawal. So what I need to make you aware of is the refund amount does go down, obviously, the closer we get towards exams. So at the moment, we're at 100 at the moment, and it will gradually go down as we go closer. And then there's a point where there will be no refund because we'll be close to exams and you've kind of been in the whole semester. Okay. I guess people online can't hear me, but here we go. The other thing is we have a fee relief policy available. So most of you have enrolled, but I mean, if you weren't aware of this policy and do need to take advantage, that's still available for you. There are some criteria which you have to qualify for that in terms of a level of salary where you're based. There are also some qualifying countries. So if you do want to check that out, that is on the website. And if you feel maybe you will fall into that range, that gives you a 50% discount on the enrollment. And so if you weren't aware of that and you want to check that out, that's on our website, and just get in contact with us if you feel that you did qualify and we can fix that up for you. When you were enrolling, we also asked you to nominate where you would like to sit your exam, so your exam center. And as part of that, we have a lot of standard exam centers all over the world. But where we have students that we only have one student sitting, we will need to arrange a temporary exam center for them. So we will be in contact with people shortly. Some people have already nominated that, and there's a form involved with that. And you just send that in, and then we help you sit wherever you are located. And we have also access arrangements. So the whole point is just basically to make it as convenient as possible for people to be able to sit their exam where they are. For those of you, I know a couple of you do move throughout the year and you have different places that you need to go, so we'd ask you to get in contact as soon as possible because it does take a little bit of time to arrange that. We cannot arrange it a day before the exam, so if you are aware possibly of work or anything is planning to transfer you or anything like that, just make us aware so that we can be prepared and help you to sit your exams. Special consideration is a policy that we have in place as well just to support you with sitting your exams in the best environment. So this is if you need any change to the exam conditions. Examples are perhaps if you break your hand or something like that and you need a special way to get into the exam. If you have a special keyboard you need to bring with you to the exam center, you need to put in a special consideration policy. A special consideration application, and then we send that on to the chief examiners. That's just to make them aware that there has been a change to the exam conditions. so that they know that anything special is being brought in or any changes. That policy is also available for you after the exam. And in terms of the exam, that's if you had an incident during the exam. So we get students who maybe are sick on the day and they couldn't perform at their best. This is available for you. So if you go on and read it, it does give you an outline of what sort of things are considered. And if you have anything that impacts you during or before the exam, we always encourage you to put this in so that we can make the examiners aware of your full situation when you set the exam. Exam performance interviews are available for you after the exam. There is some eligibility criteria for that as well, but it's an opportunity to speak to the chief examiners on your attempt. And so if you haven't passed the exam and you're a C average, you get an opportunity to sit with the examiner. They go through your attempt. They let you know where you didn't perform so well or where you can improve. And it's usually done over the phone, and it's also available for anyone who's out of Sydney. You can do that as well through Skype and that sort of thing. So, and then, yeah, there's a whole bunch of forms obviously available on the website, but if you do have any questions or anything that you're looking for, not sure where to look for, just contact us and we can direct you to that. In week 5, we'll be sending you what will be your candidate number, which will be your unique identifier for your exam. If you're taking the post-course assignment for CAP, this is what you will use. So obviously, we can't have names or any identifiers when we attempt exams, so this is sort of what will become your identifier throughout the semester. It will be a series of 6 digits. It will be slightly different for those who are sitting course 7A, because we get a unique one from the UK for you. But if you are sitting the Actuaries Institute exams, you will get your candidate number to put on your assignments, to put on your exam attempts. So we ask you, obviously, to remember this number. At this point, do we have any questions? This is very exciting. When we have a quiet group like this, we can cruise. But no, I'm sure we'll have more questions when these guys get up. So this is just a little bit on the assessments and, you know, the different things that are involved with each of the modules. So for those of you sitting course 7A, which is in module 1, it is made up of 2 components. You will have the ST9 exam, which makes up 100% of the assessment. Then you also have to attend the workshop. So that is compulsory. For completion of module 1 for ST9, you have to have done both those components. You don't have to do them in the same semester. So for example, if you sit the exam this semester and you want to do the workshop next semester, that you can do it that way as well. If you do happen to sit the exam and do the workshop in this semester and maybe not pass the exam, you don't have to attend the workshop again. So you have to do each of them once. For ST1, which is the health component, if you choose that pathway, the exam again, which is a UK-based exam, which is the ST1 exam. And then you have to complete the online private health insurance course. So both of those components need to be complete for you to have completed your module 1. So for module 2, the assessment is made up of an exam, which makes up the large component of the assessment, which is 90%. And then there is the online forum participation mark. So the online forum, you will access that in the LMS, and I will just go through a bit later about what are the requirements that you need to gain your 10%. For module 4, which is CAP, it's got a slightly different component. It's got the case study exam, which, as Tony has already let you know, is an 8-hour exam. That goes the whole day, and then we also get the post-course assignment. So for those sitting CAP the first time, you have to attend the residential course, and you get your assignments soon after the residential course. So the course is in March, and then you get 2 weeks to complete your assignment, and you hand that in, and we mark it, and we give it back to you before the exam. And then you sit the exam as well. So that component is slightly different in terms of the amount, 20% for the assignments and 80% for the exam. Okay, so this is just a little more information. The module 2 and 3 exam is a 3-hour exam. It's an open book exam. And so you can bring calculator, you can bring any notes that are printed out. And it's an exam environment, so we encourage you not to bring a suitcase, but you can bring whatever you need with you to the exam. During the exam, it's done on a computer, so it's a computer-based exam. You have access to Word, you have access to Excel. The internet is blocked throughout the exam. And then we also provide you with the standard digital materials. So the textbooks will be available for you in soft copy, course materials, any readings that are part of the course will be available for you, but you know, I know some people like to write their notes on the reading, so they may bring that with them. And is it right? Just some technical difficulties. Very sorry to the people online who can't hear us at the moment. We're trying to solve that. So that's the exam for modules 2 and 3. Now we're just going to go a little bit into the online discussion forum. So this is the section, the picture there is just the section that you'll see in the LMS and what it looks like. The discussion forum is the one at the top. There's a little bit of guidance around the marks and obviously how to view the posts. All right, so this is what is required for the online discussion forum. So candidates will be required to make 6 posts of up to 200 words to the compulsory discussion forum. And what that is 2 of those posts must be original posts, so you initiate a discussion, and then 4 posts you're responding to other people's discussions. I've already let you know that the assessment makes up 10%, but we will, I know Bruce here is a forum moderator, so he'll give you a little more detail on how important that is. And in the pack, you'll also just see a guideline on how the forum is actually marked. So we just ask you to read through this, you know, and be aware of what it is we're looking for when you put those posts. So the importance of the forum participation. So I know it's 10%, and it may sound like, oh, okay, if I concentrate on all my studies, I can get by without the 10%. Now, we just want to let you know that this 10% is very important. When we come to the end of the semester and we're looking at marks and somebody's on the borderline, this is the difference between a pass and a fail. This a small amount here. So we just encourage you to just take it seriously, not to wait until the end of the semester as well, where it's the day before and you do all your 6 posts on that day, because that is assessed as well, your participation in the whole throughout the semester. So, you know, get started on it. Obviously, it's always, you know, a bit, nobody wants to be the first, I guess, to start, but, you know, we encourage you just to get involved. You can just have a look in there and just you know, think of somebody to get involved in, and Bruce will just give you a little bit more information, and as well as our students here, on how to get started with that and how to get involved. So from last semester, 47% of the students achieved the top mark. And course 6A was the lowest engagement, and then it was followed by course 2A. So that's just a summary of the participation marks. The slide pack will be available for you online, so if you want to just delve into that and get a little bit of an idea as to how it goes. So we do have people there who choose not to do it. As you can see, we had about 13 last semester who chose not to take advantage of those marks. So we just encourage you to get involved. So this year, Tony spoke a little bit about this. So this is the Part 3 pass rates. As you can see, it goes up and down. For last semester, it's at 37%. No, 36, I think it was. 36%. And this is just a summary for you guys to get an idea. That 3 years, we talked about the amount of work it takes to pass Part 3 and just what's involved. And so these people here are, you know, I'm pretty sure they were all smart like you guys, and they're all trying, and so we want this to go up, and we want you guys to be the ones to do it. So we just encourage you to just, you know, give it your all. So I'm going to hand over to Bruce now, who's going to be the first of the chief examiners speaking to you, and then we'll hear from the others, and there'll be opportunities all along the way for any questions.
Hi, I'm Bruce, and yes, I'm Chief Examiner for CAP. I'm also a tutor and the facilitator of the forum for 2A Life Insurance. And so my question is, who are you? Hands up, please, if you have done a Part 3 course before. Thank you. Hands up if you were at uni last year. Not everybody. Good. Okay, just we want a little bit of a flavour there. They say that if you ask a question of 2 actuaries, you get 3 answers. Well, if you ask a bunch of actuaries, it's going to be even worse, isn't it? The good news, though, is your job is to figure what works for you. Everybody's different, and the things that each of us say or suggest tonight, not all of them will be good for you, but some of them hopefully are. Pick up what will work for you. My first thing that I want to talk about is motivation. We techos tend to underestimate the value of emotional things like motivation, and yet, believe it or not, it works on us too. How do you motivate yourself to study? How do you motivate yourself to study enough to pass? Is it self-respect? Hey, 70% of people are going to fail anyway, it's not so bad if I fail. Is it money? Are you going to be motivated by a pay rise when most of your mates are probably paid less than you are anyway? Maybe you should put yourself in a position where you need the money, right? Negatively gear into an overpriced Sydney property. Whatever works for you. Reward yourself. Motivate yourself. If the money, if the self-respect are not sufficiently visible and immediate as rewards, give yourself rewards. Hey, I'm going to do such and such this week, and then I'm going to get this reward. Right? When you come to do management courses, you might be, or you might have already heard about objective should be SMARTA. S-M-A-R-T-A stands for specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, timed, meaning by when am I going to do this? And the last one's not so relevant for your study timetable, it's agreed to be. Right, so make sure that you set yourself some objectives that are specific, measurable, relevant, etc. Right, and then reward yourself. Motivate yourself by saying, hey, I'm going to do this by Friday, and then I'm going to eat an ice cream or whatever it is that drives you, right? Yeah, the real world's a bit different at uni, isn't it? At uni, you don't have much money. Now you've got money, but now you don't have the time to spend it. You will not pass part three subjects by memorising the course material. At uni you can probably pass and often pass well by knowing all the course material. Here it is necessary, but it is not sufficient. You need to get some background from outside the course material. Now how you get it is up to you, but it's the most difficult thing usually, particularly if you're not working in a large company, because you need to have lunch with the other people who work in your company, or the actuaries or non-actuaries, right, and have a chat about what their work is, what the issues are in their work, right? Hopefully you can do that with your friends that you went to uni with or that you know in other companies without quite getting into the industrial espionage state, right, to find out what is going on out there in the industry. Yes, you should read the financial review or similar. No, you shouldn't read it cover to cover every day of the week. But you've got to get an idea of what's going on out there in the industry, right? If you're working in general insurance, they probably haven't got claims farming in the course material yet, or have they? Right? But that's the sort of issue that's likely to be in the exam, right? And if you don't know what that is, you better find out, haven't you? Right? But that's the sort of thing that's going on out there. Genetic testing in life insurance is in the media, right? Yes, it's in the textbook, but it's probably 10 lines, right? You've got to understand what this means for an actuary designing a product, what this means for an actuary managing a block of business, what this means for an actuary who's called to give expert witness in court, what this means for a consumer, right? Because when you're going to answer a question, you are going to need to answer it or be aware of the different viewpoints, right? And you have to consider not just the product actuary, but also maybe the valuation actuary, the regulator, the reinsurer, the consumer, the houses that recommend products, right? How many different viewpoints can you think of? And there may be aspects of that required in your exam answer. A study plan. You've got to, well, why are you studying? Why are you trying to pass? Okay, if you want to be a good actuary, and maybe something beyond that, then you've got to pass. That's the gate that we've unfortunately set up to test whether you are, in theory, at least a good actuary. So you've got to study, you've got to learn, you've got to understand. But you've got to understand the principles, not just the text. You probably have to do the course at least twice. Now, the easiest way of doing it at least twice is to fail it. The harder way of doing it at least twice is to cram it into one semester. And that probably means reading the course material pretty much like a novel, right? So that you have an idea of what's in there, and then going back and starting again and saying, right, now I'm going to learn it and I'm going to think about it. And when I'm reading chapter 1, I've got in the back of my mind that there's something in chapter 19 that applies to this. And I can put that in context. And when you go through it that second or third time, don't just think that doing it the same as last week or a month ago is going to be good. You've got to do it differently. Again, how do you do it differently? Does that mean you sit down with someone and chat it through? Does that mean you tell her something or other about chapter 7 and she tells you something about chapter 8? Whatever works for you. Small groups work well. The Institute occasionally collects statistics on people who are in small groups and whether they pass more than those who do it alone. The answer is yes, they do. Now, is it a chicken or egg? I don't know, of course, right? Is it just that the more motivated people are motivated to get into small groups? Right? But make it work for you. Don't aim to pass the course. Aim to kill it. Particularly if you're doing 2A or 3A or 6A. Well, hey, guess what's coming next? 2B or 3B or 6B. And if you don't know all the basic material, you're not going to have a good head start into the B course. So don't aim to get 51% and then you get a little bit unlucky and you get 49%. In fact, it's not 49, 59% probably fails you, right? About 60% is usually what you need for a pass. So don't aim for 61%. Aim for 70% plus. And then if there's an accident or something that's really nasty or whatever, you still end up passing, right? Don't aim to scrape through. Discipline. Make sacrifices. I'm starting rumours. The Winter Olympics is not on this year. The Commonwealth Games has been cancelled. The Tennis Australian Open has been rained out, and the cricket has finished for the year. Etc., etc. For your interests, if you think you are going to maintain your lifestyle and pass one of these subjects, then you are either brilliant, in which case you're probably not in this room, or you are deluded because it ain't gonna happen, right? You must make some sacrifices to get through. 20 hours a week for a few months is not an awful lot. Put it in early because in the long run it pays off. It is better to do 99% of your capacity for one semester rather than 80% of your capacity, you'll probably do 4 semesters. Right? The maths is easy, isn't it? Allocate specific study time to the topic you don't like. It's always easy to work on the ones that we enjoy or we half know anyway or we understand. Figure out the ones you don't like. Right? And then if that means you go and talk to somebody about it, well, hey, whatever works. Use the forum. And the forum minimum is 2 originals plus 4 responses to other people. Well, yeah, that's the minimum, but that is not going to get you 9 or 10 out of 10. not 2 plus 4, 4 plus 10 is probably more like it if you want to get a good mark. What if English is not strong, your English, because it's a second language to you, or whatever the reason is, recognise that and allow for it. That you need extra care in reading the exam questions, that you need extra care in understanding the textbook, that you have to take more copious study notes, whatever it is, right? Be careful, because it is very easy to read something that you are expecting rather than reading what's actually there. Right? And there's lots of psychology that's built around this, and you can do tests and find that people will just see what they are expecting. Right? And that's what it's all about, underlying keywords in exams and reading the exam several times, right? And when I say several times, I don't just mean reading it and then reading it again. I mean, halfway through your answer to a question, you need to go back and have a look at the question. Because by then you've got a fair idea what you're writing about and what it's all about. Go back to the question and go, oh, there's that word I hadn't really focused on. Now I understand why that word's in there. I need to write about it. Professionalism, the code of conduct. Read it once, and then the thing you need to remember is to be truthful. That's all. Whether the report or answer is to your client or the boss or somebody else, all this code of conduct stuff means don't mislead, be truthful. If you are tempted to start going, oh, look, I'll just push that part to the side, be really careful. Is there anybody doing CAP in the immediate future? Yeah, particularly in CAP, be very careful because the questions will test your professionalism there. You need to be aware not to just take the easy way through here, not to just go, oh, this is a bit embarrassing if I've got to admit that I've made a mistake. This is a bit embarrassing if I've got to write the opposite of what the question is saying. Right? Be truthful and you'll be safe. In summary, putting it all in context, your life does not depend on passing these exams, but your livelihood does. Figure out what learning method is going to work for you so that you understand the material and so you can apply it, right? Not so you can regurgitate it, right? That'll get you 30 or 40%, right? Not the 60 or 70% you need to pass, right? It's necessary but not sufficient that you know all the material. You have to be able to apply it, and that means having a chat with somebody having a chat with somebody while you are studying, and if that's a small group or whatever it is, or at work, over lunch, over a drink, right? Talking to people, what are the issues, what are they doing about them? That's the sort of thing you need in order to be a good actuary. And not coincidentally, that's the sort of thing you need in order to pass. I should have said at the start I was happy to take questions as we went, but have you got any questions for me at the moment? All good. I'm going to pass over to Anthony.
Yes, thank you, Bruce. I sort of covered a fair bit of what I was planning on covering, but...
Oh, sorry.
As he said, listen perspectives and what works for you. So who's doing Module 2-3, Part A, Part B of a particular special subject? First time? And is it the second half of the subject you've already done, or is it the first time? First time for the first half of the subject. And have you read all the material yet? As Bruce has said, you know, you can do the courses several times, or you can try and get it done through several times in the one semester. There is a huge amount of material to cover. If you think about the exam could ask you anything to do with life insurance or general insurance, or investments. It's a huge field. You may be lucky, and Bruce has done extremely well. He never gets to see the exam paper beforehand, but has 80% plus guessed at least one of the questions in the exam paper based on what's going on in the market and his view of the world. So listening to the tutors and getting involved in the forums and getting those discussions happening can sometimes give you insights into what sorts of things likely to be examined. But there's a huge amount of material there. David's earlier comment about work-life balance. No, it's work-study balance. Life waits. Okay? You do not have a social life. Back in the old days, when there were four subjects and you did all four of them, I did get married and have a child the year I qualified, but that was, she was born after the exam. That maybe a stress relief is a different question, but that's another point. But seriously, there's an awful lot of work in and how to get it through and to understand it. And as Bruce mentioned, you've got to be able to think of things from a whole lot of different perspectives. Okay, you might be asked, you are the product actuary, you are the marketing actuary, you are a consultant. So if you don't have that role as the role you're working in, go and find someone in that role and talk to them about every subject in the topic. You know, so you could be talking about new product development or you could be talking about valuation, but get a feel for the sorts of challenges and the things they have issues with. Touch real life, real people, and they can sometimes give you a rather interesting perspective. Sometimes it doesn't work. When I was back in the old days when we had assignments, I did an assignment when I was working for MLC. We were asked to give a surrender value basis, and I was told it was far too complex, it would never be used in practice. But it was MLC surrender value basis at the time for their traditional business. It was just very, very specific to make sure you got the dollar amount right, because there was rounding up and rounding down and all those sorts of things. But 90% of the time, having real life knowledge and experience of how things really happen will at least give you an appreciation of things. Don't just think, I'm the actuary working for a life insurance company, so I'm looking from the company's perspective. What about the shareholder's perspective? What about the policyholder's perspective? And having worked there for 9 years up until recently, what about the regulator's perspective? I can tell you our perspective is sometimes unique and not always very encouraging. The sorts of things you see done in practice out there can be very questionable. And most importantly, if you're answering something, make sure you're saying what is being done can be done. The best way to fail is to breach the Life Insurance Act or the General Insurance Act and to recommend something that is illegal. It has been done. Sometimes the papers will actually be very specific and tell you, you aren't in Australia, you are in this country very much similar to Australia, this, this, and this. But it has these requirements. And then you're asked a question. Make sure you're meeting those requirements and not forgetting those requirements spelled out when you're answering the paper, because you might be answering something which is fine in theory, but not meeting those requirements. If you're not given requirements, if you're not given things, state what your assumptions are. Sometimes if you're giving a wrong answer, but you've made the wrong answer because you've assumed something stupid, you can still get marks for that. Unless, of course, the question asks you about morbidity and you start to give out mortality. And again, I have seen that happen a lot too. So as Bruce has said, read the question. See what they're asking and think about it. Also look for the words. We've been drilled, us volunteers in writing exam papers, about what does compare versus list versus give the pros and cons or the advantages and disadvantages. All of these mean different things for the ways you should answer the question. Are you providing a list? Are you discussing? Are you writing a memo in response? Who is your audience? How technical or plain English must your language be? All of these things can have a bearing in how clear it is to understand you and your answer. Remember, now you're working with Excel and with Word. Please make sure you're very familiar with how to use both of those tools. And look at ways of making it easy to find your answers if you've been using in a spreadsheet so that they can easily be found. There's nothing worse than trying to wander through a spreadsheet and find out where their answer is. When you don't have the right answer, then we do have to wander through and find out, well, where did you go wrong? Thank goodness we're only working in Excel, not APL2, because you just cannot debug APL2 programs, for those of you old enough to know old mathematical programming languages. Okay, who here has never asked a stupid question? Does So everyone admits to asking a stupid question sometime in the past? Okay, do it. Lots of it. Because it's the best way to learn. You know, in your forum questions, it can be. I don't understand what's going on in the textbook. Can someone please explain this to me? At least it gets the discussion started. If you have experience in an area because you're working in an area that's covered in the course, then tell people about your experiences. Don't breach confidentiality and commerciality, but you at least talk about, you know, these sorts of basics. And please don't go and take it and use it at work. Okay? Because it may not be the total story. But there is value in doing that sort of thing, sharing your knowledge and helping each other learn. There are these wonderful things called chief examiner's reports that have descriptions, all the individual stuff about who passed and who failed and all the meaty stuff is pulled out. But all the discussion about how well the question was answered, the common mistakes that were done, the points the candidates missed are all listed there. So when you've got time, and it should be from the next 2 or 3 weeks because you've already covered the course 2 or 3 times and you're starting to do the old exam papers, do the exam papers without looking at the answers first. Then see, did you fall into the same mistakes that the majority of candidates that the chief examiner on that course talked about they missed? Because that might give you a point to where your learning needs to improve. Did you capture some of those things that said most people missed this point? Because that might show you've got an insight and a good understanding on some of these things. And then go and try a different question. But you'll see time and time again, chief examiners writing, the candidates did not answer the question that was asked. They throw book learning at it. Where you've got to step back and go, okay, I know my book learning, or at least you should. And I can tell you, we have real problems in life insurance about the number of candidates who cannot do simple multiple decrement tables, or cannot do simple projections. And it's a worry because that's stuff that you should have learned at university and be the book work that should be the precursor to getting into these courses. And we expect you to be able to do it. So if you are a bit rusty on some of your old university stuff, or those of you who didn't just leave university last year, make sure you do a bit of practice in those sorts of things. Because they can be useful to make sure that if there is a question that says, please project the 10-year cash flow of these things, or present value of premiums, or that sort of thing, you can remember how to do it. And if you're dealing with death and TPD, or trauma, or disability, what's that look like? Because it's not just theory. Though I will say the only time I have ever used commutation functions was when I worked in Japan for 2 years. And all of your premium formulas must be submitted to the regulator in commutation functions. It was frightening. I hadn't seen them since second year of university. It brought them back home and yes, can remember how to use them. Haven't used them since. And that was 1998. Who wasn't alive in 1998? It was a long time ago. There's been a whole lot of change too over times in the people who are studying and working full time, how much study leave you get and how much support there is within that employment network. If you're the only candidate, and I have been in a company where I was the only candidate sitting actuarial exams, not only just that subject, you need to find ways to develop the networks and the peer support. Often the organisations that do best with their candidates who pass have a mentor for students within the unit, within that company, that they have someone that's seen as the source person for that subject who helps coordinate study groups or discussion groups, that sort of thing. Step up, be the person to volunteer for that sort of thing. Get the work going because A, it will help you with your studies, and B, your company might actually see you as a go-getter who will do things who will know and could get your promotion even if you don't pass the exam first time. But don't underestimate the value of those sorts of networking groups, whether it be through the online resource, old university friends, people that you are studying with because you don't have time to socialise together and it's the only way you actually get to see anyone else, or through work. And they can be virtual as well as physical groups, so that there are companies that are both Sydney and Melbourne based who have online networks of students. I think I've covered just about everything. The past exam papers, dealing in networks, making sure if you know how to work with spreadsheets that you're working with them well. And don't be afraid to ask those stupid questions, because it's the only way you'll learn. If you only ask smart questions that you know an answer to, then you've not learnt anything. And if you can answer someone else's stupid question, then you're learning how to communicate better, and hopefully not telling them it's a stupid question, but explain it to them in a way which helps you learn your communication skills, because that's also a very important part for actuaries. So with that in mind, I'll pass on to David, unless anyone has any specific questions to my repetition of Bruce's things in different words. Over to you, Dave.
Sorry, gone to sleep. My foot's gone to sleep there. Apologies now, because you're really going to hear the same thing for a third time. But then again, repetition does sometimes work. Look, just to go on with some expanding some of the points the others have said and to relate to my own experience, the very first year I sat what was the equivalent of a Part 3 exam, I joined two study groups. It was very demotivating to be the only person out of the seven people that didn't pass. So I will say that study groups can be very, very helpful. In terms of what else can help you pass exams and be motivated, it took me two attempts to pass every subject. So exams were only once a year, and it took me 6 years to qualify. I passed three of those subjects after I got married, and only one subject before I got married. Whereas Anthony said...
Your study coach was who?
the other bit was that whereas Anthony had a child the year he passed his last exam, I told my wife we weren't allowed to have children until after I passed exams, and she was ready to have children and I hadn't qualified. So motivation does come in very many different forms, but find out what's important to you, okay? Look, what I thought I'd try to do tonight was put up some study, go through and get some study and exam tips. I didn't get as far as I liked because I was trying to do a Family Feud episode tonight where I surveyed 100 actuaries and asked them for their number one study tip and what was their number one exam tip, and then we'd see how we went. I did get through about 20 responses from colleagues at work, so I was pretty happy with that. So I thought I'd actually try and share those with you tonight. Is this presentation going to be available to them so they don't have to scribe at the tonight? You can go through it later at your own leisure. But I would like to see a little bit more discussion than what we've had so far as we're going through them. So just before we start on the very first slide, some other background is I've been involved in the examination process twice. I was chief examiner and assistant examiner back in the early 2000s and got involved again two or three years ago. The very first meeting I went to as an examiner, the other examiners explained something to me. So if I could ask for every third person to stand up in the room, please. Okay. Should be, hopefully you can count so that every third person is standing. Every third person. So I'd like to see one in three people standing. This is guys, this is not a good sign of your exam. Okay, bad luck guys. You've automatically failed the exam because you didn't study hard enough during the process. It was basically this was one of the things that I was told, that roughly one third of the candidates have no chance of passing the exams because they've not put the effort in to trying to pass the exam. Okay, could everyone else who wasn't standing up now stand up, and those that were standing sit down? Okay, all you guys have done the amount of work to pass the exam. Okay, so roughly speaking, two thirds of the people going into the exam have actually done the preparation to get through the exam. Okay, it's just a matter then of how you actually perform on the day as to who gets through. I was roughly told that one in two of everyone who's now standing will perform on the day and pass the exam, and the other one in two won't, which is why when you look at that, that's roughly 33% of people pass the exam. You get plus or minus 5% variation, and the pass rate comes out between 28 and 38%. That's what I was told the very first exam meeting I turned up to. Obviously, what we would rather see is have 100% of the people standing up having done enough work to actually pass the exam, and then still more than 50% of you actually performing on the day. We don't have a quota. There is no quota that says we only want X number of people to pass. I know that the year I passed life insurance, the life insurance pass rate was 50% in the subject. So it can actually happen. I've also seen other subjects where the pass rate was 17%. So it is actually based on the people who perform on the day and the performance of the exam, etc. So no quotas, okay? So if you think there is a quota, get that out of your mind. If we have 70% or 80% of the people who've just demonstrated enough knowledge to pass the exam, we will pass 80% of the people. Okay. All right, well, if you want to sit back down, I'll let you go. Okay, so if we just move on to some general study tips, etc. And some of these are in contrast to some of the comments you've already heard before, but this is from a range of individuals from what worked for themselves. So I'd suggest that you actually, in going through them, work out what you actually think works for you, and I'll give you some advice on some of the ones that worked for me and in particular. And I will say that I'd like to thank also all my colleagues at KPMG because they responded very quickly to my request for this. And I'll also give the students in 2A a bit of a warning, just for extra motivation. We have approximately 8 students enrolled in the 2A course this semester. And one of our partners is very determined that we have an extremely high pass rate. Okay, so there's a lot of effort and a lot of support going into to help our candidates. So if you're sitting 2A, you're going to want to work very hard to keep up. Okay, so there's some extra motivation and competition.
Yeah.
Okay. I'd also like to say that the tips aren't just from recent qualifiers. The very first person who responded to my survey that I sent out was the partner in charge. So if you think about whether you want to approach experienced actuaries or just recently qualified actuaries, experienced actuaries are more than willing to stop and help students at any time. So if you are in an environment where you have that opportunity, take it, because they remember when they were a student what was done for them. And there's a strong tradition of actuaries helping other actuaries along the way. Okay. Of the ones particularly on this first page, the one I found most helpful that was suggested to me before I started studying Part 3 exams was study before work and not after. Okay. I got into work at 7 o'clock every morning. I actually then studied through from 7 o'clock through to 9:30 to 10 o'clock each day. And then I started my normal work at 10 o'clock. I had an extremely supportive boss because he was the one who suggested that. So in about the 3 years I studied with him, he interrupted my study sessions about 5 times over 3 years. So he recognised that I was studying. It meant that I got my study done first. It was done. I was a morning person. If you're not a morning person, it's not going to work. But it meant I got my study done. It was out of the way. I'd done good quality study whilst I was fresh. I then worked during the day. I then went home and I didn't open a book at night. Okay? But that's what I meant. That's what worked for me. Okay? But it's about that's how I prioritised effort into getting into my study. And that got me towards the 15 hours of the 20 to 25 hours of study I was trying to do a week. Okay. The other one that there's particularly easy is, but mind you, we only get 3 questions in the exam now, not like 5 to 6 questions that we have to do, but do the easiest question first. You do not have to answer the questions in any particular order. Do what you're most comfortable with first. Don't overspend time doing that question, but work your way into the exam. Okay. The second last point there about the exam tip about understanding the material and how much stuff you can take in. I've never ever heard of anyone really doing well by that referred to having to open up their books during the exam to find material. I know it's open book. Somebody else in here has a tip to have a really good reference and filing system so you can find things quickly. But it is actually about understanding the material, not regurgitating the material. Okay. Yeah.
It's interesting that the first.
Oh, the first exam tip.
It sort of contradicts Bruce's point earlier.
Hey, I'm just writing down what I was submitted.
The answer to that would be that as an examiner, what we're looking for is for someone to demonstrate they're capable of acting as a fellow. If we passed you, we're basically saying you have the ability to be a fellow. So passing the exam, you've got to be able to demonstrate that you're going to be a fellow.
I could give some other examples there in that it doesn't mean that you have to know, say there's 8 points related to an issue. You don't have to know all 8. If you quote 6 of the 8 points, that's enough to demonstrate knowledge and move on. Okay? An expert might know all eight, and an expert might actually know more than the eight relevant points. But the idea is that you're looking at how do you want to pass the exam. If becoming an expert in all facets of the course is the best way you think of passing the exam, then learn all facets. But you're here, I'm not saying it's a gaming process, but you're here to want to learn to how to pass the exam, and you've got to work out what's going to work for yourself.
Okay. With that one, it's better to give those six than to get a seventh that's wrong. If you're trying to get all 8 points and you throw down something that's wrong, that's going to be a far worse result for you than giving the six you're confident with. Because that seventh one will then say, well, do they really know what they're talking about? Because they're starting to throw nonsense out there. And can I say that to fellow? You really need to be careful about being sure of what you're saying and not just throwing anything down there to try and get eight because there's 8 marks to get.
Okay, on the next lot, I'd actually jump to the second last one there about spread your study out over the term. How many of you in your uni courses left most of your study until the last 2 weeks before the exam? How many of you, well, for you guys who was successful, how did you find that worked in trying to do part three?
I didn't do that for these.
Yeah, not a chance, yeah. You've got no chance, okay? If you think you can learn the entire course in the last 2 to 3 weeks, give up now, okay? These courses require a consistent amount of work and effort. They require you to study at the start of the course. It requires you to study consistently through the course. It requires a lot of revision and past exam papers at the end of the course, okay? My suggestion generally, by the way, would be that you're probably wanting to allow at least a month at the end of the course for revision and past exam papers. So that means getting, how many weeks do you actually have from now to the exam? Was it 15, 16, 13, 14 weeks? 15? Okay. Well, in that case, that means you've got about 11 weeks to make sure you've gone through the course at least twice. We're advised, when I first started life insurance, one of the things that Bruce said, read the textbook entirely from cover to cover. Spend 2 to 3 weeks doing that before you then actually go into actually the course material. Now, it's a very condensed amount of time, but if you think about how much effort you're going to try and do, it's virtually impossible to catch up if you fall behind. Okay. Hence the other point about start early. The other one I actually thought was quite astute, and this one came from somebody who never failed one of the part three exams, this last point, was read the question twice, but answer it only once. Okay? You have reading time, so use your reading time wisely. Don't use your reading time to try and get a head start on just the very first question, think about it. Use the reading time to get through the whole exam, work out what are the key issues you have to worry about, and plan your approach. Okay. All right, so the next ones, a lot of these next ones on this page fall into the work-life study balance. If I jump to the middle one there, you've got to study regularly. You do have to have time off to relax and pursue some hobbies. Otherwise, you just do go stir crazy. In my example, if I give you, I never studied on a Saturday. So I did my study Monday to Friday from 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock in the mornings, and I studied Sunday, and I never opened a book on a Saturday. So that was my time off. So work out how you want to reward yourself. But that was basically my reward mechanism. It was like if I'd had a good week, I'd have Saturday morning off to chill out. Saturday afternoon, I played competition tennis. Saturday night, I went out with a girlfriend. Sunday, I was back at study. So work out what you want to do. But work out how you're going to take time off to relax. Any questions or comments? I mean, you can feel free to challenge anything you see up there. Okay. Now, the next one's interesting because what I just did was I took what I was given and just recorded it. This is an example from one person who didn't follow the instructions from my email of the survey of, I asked for one study tip and one exam tip, okay? And they felt so keen they'd provided four study tips and two exam tips. If I draw your attention to the first of their exam tips, if a question is worth 5 marks, assume 1 mark per point and therefore include 5 points. That's pretty old school. And that was in my day what you were basically told to try and approach. The examiners have gone far more easier in their approach to candidates these days. And the questions will often be very specific, as in list two advantages and three disadvantages. Or it will say, it will actually tell you discuss 4 points or raise 4 issues. If it does say 4 issues, then make sure the first 4 issues are the important ones that you want to talk about. If you write down 6, the last 2 may not get marked. Okay, I know some markers take the view that you're asked to supply 4, therefore I expect the first 4 to be the key ones, and therefore the last two may not count. Against that, when it's coming to sort of a borderline judgment, the other two will count. Okay, if we can see that you've got judgment, etc., along those lines, then it is there. So I mean, it is a conundrum there, but just be aware that more and more markers are saying that because the students are being told how many points or things they want to be raised, they will only mark the first 4 if it said 4. Okay, so some of them are getting a bit tougher.
In a similar line, if it says discuss 4 advantages and disadvantages, and you give 8 advantages, you'll only get 4 marks because you only give 4 of each side. So again, pay attention to what the question's asking and don't just give what you know and not think about the other side of it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I'm not quite sure whether the person was being in jest or not about promoting Red Bull. I'll leave that up to yourself to work out goes. I must admit, I start most of my days with Coke Zero, so it's maybe something related. Yeah. Look, the last one I think is quite important on there. If you're in a study group, etc., about marking your own practice exams, I think it's far better that you get somebody else to mark your practice exams, be it somebody else in your study group or a qualified fellow at work, rather than mark them yourself. I tend to have a belief that most people aren't honest with themselves when they're marking themselves, and that they think, oh yeah, what I was saying was close enough to the point in the solution, therefore I'll actually get it. A colleague will be more honest than that, so you'll get better feedback if you can find someone else to mark your exams. Marking someone else's exam is also a great way of actually learning, because you'll actually learn more about exam technique, the way people present it, because you'll actually see what somebody else has done, etc. So I would definitely suggest that you try and buddy up with someone else to make sure that you exchange exam papers at one stage. I would also say that when you try and do past exam questions, at least once, do the exam in the exam session time. Actually practice that at that time of day that the exam is, go for the straight 3 hours, 15 minutes through. It can be you may be quite surprised at how mentally fatiguing it can be, and unless you actually train yourself to do that. For Bruce, it was a lot harder because he had to front up for 6 hours of exams every day in every subject. So he had to do a 3-hour paper in the morning and a 3-hour paper in the afternoon. So you really would also practice in those days, doing 6 hours in a day just so that you weren't brain dead for the second paper. Okay. Now, I won't say who the actuary is, but the middle point on the right-hand side there. Don't forget the easy marks for clearly answering the easy parts of the question, and this means stating the obvious. Probably one of the most brilliant actuaries I know, who passed every subject, got the highest grade in every subject they ever did, took 5 attempts at one subject to qualify. And that was the area he worked in. In the end, he worked out that he was forgetting to state the obvious. He was actually putting down all the little tricky points that he knew related to that material in every answer and forgot to state the obvious, and therefore missed most of the marks. Okay, so it's not being too smart, but yeah, just state the obvious.
and we write the exam, it's specifically focused on asking questions of someone who has no knowledge beyond the text learnings, so no experience knowledge in the industry, because you don't know if you've got someone who's working in life insurance and sitting in life insurance papers. So you can't assume knowledge from to pick up an experience. So the stuff you do know can be helpful to some people to give them background and breadth and to look at perspectives, but it won't necessarily earn you lots and lots of marks, unless you're really, really lucky.
Yeah.
For most of the life paper and not the 25-mark question on developing a new product, and I've been doing that for the last 6 months.
Okay, the two of the next points under the exam is somewhat related, and it's about how you use your time in the exam. It's far better to get the first 60 to 70% of the marks in a question and move on than to spend the extra 5 or 10 minutes thinking about how to try and get the other 30%. Okay? Time management is critical. In my day, it was a 3-hour exam, it was 100 marks, so everyone used to say it was 1.8 minutes per mark. And then they'd come out of the exam not finished. My rule of thumb was it was 1.5 minutes per mark, and therefore I was trying to do the exam in 2.5 hours, and then when I went over on every question by 5 minutes, I still finished inside the 3 hours. So be quite conscious of how you use your time, and be disciplined in relation to the time. I think I skipped one of the important ones. Other ones, sorry, I'll just... There's one in here somewhere about the examiners aren't failed novelists, which we should. I missed it again or not?
There we go.
Oops. Oops, sorry. Yeah, sorry about that. Now I've gone too far again. All right, I'll give up.
Second one.
We don't try and write long questions just to take up your time in the exam. Everything that's in the question is there for a reason. There's a point there behind every word, whether it's to give context or to help, etc. So it is why we say read the questions twice. Yeah, you read the questions twice. I know other actuaries who take a highlighter and highlight every verb in the question, so they make sure they know that if there's a doing word in the question, they actually highlight the doing word to make sure they do it. Yeah, so every bit of information is there. Now, probably the most related to that is on the last slide. Oops, still one there, aren't I? Okay. Look, if you can't, one of the things you're going to do is you are going to get thrown in the exam. There's going to be something there that you're not comfortable with. It's easy to say don't panic, but the more important thing is to have a strategy of how you're going to try and approach what you're going to do when you're not sure what the answer is. If you can't work out what the question is actually asking, go back over some of the key principles of the course, okay? And then start looking at how those key principles might apply to the question. If you then start looking at the principles of the course, what the important principles are, and you start then looking at the question, you might be able to start fleshing out an answer. It may not be a perfect answer, it may be far from a perfect answer, but it might be the difference from getting a D or an E or an F. It might get you into a C or a D, etc. That then makes the whole difference between your final grade, because what it might do is it might move you up out of that category of students who are clear failing to the borderline candidates. And then once you're in the borderline candidates, anything can happen in terms of being reviewed, in terms of judgment and your assessment. Okay, so I would definitely say you've got to think about how not to get stressed in the exam and what you're going to do when you find something that you're not comfortable with. We don't try and trick you. We try and make sure there's enough information there that everyone can answer it. We do try and make sure that the exam's a reasonable amount of time. We do have people sit the exam before it's actually given to you, given to the candidates as part of the exam preparation process. So one of the joys of being a recent qualifier is that you may be invited to scrutiny of the exam.
Unless you win a prize like these guys, we don't ask them.
Yeah, prize winners are terrible scrutinies because everything's too easy for them. It's hard to get feedback. We want feedback from someone who is like three quarters of the way through the pass list, because they're going to be honest in terms of their views of what the exam is like, as opposed to someone who, like our next speaker, is probably at the top little percentage of everything. Like his father. So he actually had a lot to live up to, so his motivation was maybe trying to beat his dad. Didn't get more prizes than your dad?
No,
bummer. So there you go, motivation works in different ways. Are there any other questions in terms of it all? As we say, these will be available so that you can actually go through them in detail and pick out which ones you like. As we say, not everything is for everyone, so work out what works for you. And that, if I had a quick show of hands, how many people are morning people? So I can see maybe four or five people are going to maybe think about the 7 o'clock start at work. I think what everyone else is going to be, studying from 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock at night, are they? Yeah. Okay, thanks.
All right. Hello, everybody. I'm Grant. I guess I've had a bit of an introduction, so I might skip that one. All you really need to know is that a year ago, I was where you are, getting ready to do my first ones, and someone mentioned this to me, and I know Bruce has already said it in different words, but I'm going to say it again. My mum's a math teacher, and she said that repetition is the best way to teach anyone anything. So, look, if you take one thing away today, it's that 33% pass rate is biased, right? Everybody who's made it this far, you know, you've done your core technicals, which aren't a joke, and like, you've done your part twos. You've made it here because you're smart and you're hardworking, right? In some capacity, right? There's still a 33% pass rate. Everyone who takes these exams is smart. So the only way to pass is to actually work hard, right? Like, that's the only way you're going to get through it. So given that, you need to put in a lot of effort to pass. It makes no sense to put in anything less than 100%, because as Bruce said, if you put in 80% and then you fail, and then you put in 80% again and you fail, you're easily getting over 100. If you just put in all your effort now, you're going to be done, and then you can move on with your life. And in that sense, you know, you got to make the sacrifices. You got to find what motivates you. You know, if what motivates you is ice cream or whatever, right? As long as it works for you. For me, the motivation was I didn't want to study anymore, right? I was sick of it. I've done it for 4 years. This is my last year. I just wanted to get it all done, right? That worked really well for me. But you find what works for you, because that's, well, it's going to motivate you, and it's going to get you through it. Pretty much it, really. Oh, the other thing you want to pass quickly as well, because you want to put in your 100% and you want to get through it, because it's only going to get harder. Oh, got a bit loud there. It's only going to get harder, right? Like, you're going to get a partner, you're going to have children, you're going to move further in your career, you're going to have less time to study, and it's just going to get more difficult, right? So just put in the effort now, you know, work really hard. You don't want to be one of those one-third that hasn't done enough work. You want to get through it, right? So 100% effort. So I'm going to repeat some stuff that other people have said, but I'm not really going to tell you how to study. I think you all have studied enough. You probably know, you know, do it under exam conditions. You know, maybe listen to music if that helps you. Don't listen to music if that doesn't help you. But it's important to use all the time you've got, right? I've done a little thing here. That's the number of weekends you got. So someone said 15 weeks, I think that's right, because you got 29 days, right? That's not a lot, you know? If you're working full time, you're probably not gonna get that much done after work. You might get some done before work, right? So you've got your weekends, you've got your study leave, that's not a lot of time. So get cracking. So the material, as everyone said, you need a deep understanding of the material. You need, like, if you just understand the content, you're going to do a lot better than if you just know the content. And there's a key difference between those two. The textbook is the first thing you should read, right? Because that tells you what's in the course, what you need to know, where you need to go for the other information as well. But the textbook, again, it's not enough, right? It should be the first thing you read, but it's not the only thing you should read. Some other stuff that you should read is the stuff they tell you to read, right? That's pretty important. The prudential standards, that one's bold because I think that's super important. That's what's going to stop you from writing something illegal, right? If you want, you know what's in those, you're not going to write something that's against the law. Because it's not the law, but it's how APRA enforces its will on life insurers and general insurers.
There's also a whole lot of things called the prudential practice guides, which are not law, but they are best practice advice from the regulator to the industry. And I'm surprised how many members of the industry have never read them.
They're all available on APRA's website, you know, very, very easily. Actuarial information and discussion notes, they're on the Actuarial Institute of Actuaries website. You know, there's tons of information in that about how these things work in practice or should maybe work in practice. They also have presentations and papers that other actuaries fellows present at things, and they're really easy to watch. Like, you don't have to really pay attention, and that's good for stuff that's just recently happened. So, is anyone doing 2B? LAGIC has only been around for a couple of years. So that's the capital standards that are currently in place now. So, in terms of past papers, there's not actually a lot of information available on that. But there's tons of stuff in the insights, because there's all this discussion on, okay, how do we actually do this? You know, this is new, we've never seen this before, what do we actually do? So, lots of information available there. Look at stuff that people have written at work. They'll reference documents, you know, like your ICAP or your financial condition report, anything really that you can get your hands on. Sometimes it's a bit confidential, so don't go distributing it or anything. Sometimes they won't give it to you or they'll feel poorly about giving it to you, but if you can get your hands on it, it's always really helpful because it puts it into context, or at least the context you're familiar with. And forum posts. This is really important. There's a lot of you, so you're going to have a ton of forum posts if everyone does, you know, 6, and you're going to have even more if everyone does 14. So that's a lot of information to digest, and I remember I read every single forum post because there's just a lot of information there, and stuff you don't think about unless someone tells you or someone brings it up and you go, oh, is that right? And then you check it, and maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong. The one little condition on that, though, is sometimes the stuff there is wrong. Don't just take it on faith. Sometimes someone will write the wrong thing, and someone might not correct it, or people might not realize. So look at it, but be critical. And that's going to help, too. If you're skeptical of the information on there, and you verify it, and then you realize you were wrong in your understanding, you're going to get it a lot better. And that's something you're going to remember, because you're going to be like, oh, crap, I didn't know that. So it's good stuff. So that's all of the stuff that you should be looking at if you want to put in that 100% effort. So past papers. I think this is the best thing you can do to prepare for these exams. I mean, nothing is quite the same as these exams, apart from the past papers. Even then, sometimes they change quite a bit over time. You can go back, depending on the exam that you're doing, really far. Like 2A, you can pretty much go back to when 2A started, because the course is pretty similar, and there's definitely going to be questions in there, even though it's not a computer-based exam really early on. You should still be looking at them and still be thinking about them. And maybe you do them with a computer, and you maybe adjust the time that you're going to do it, but think about how you're going to do those past papers that are really early on, because that's going to give you perspective on questions moving forward as well. And you can save those computer-based ones for the very end, where you're getting like really close to the exam. So my suggestion is you read the textbook for the first time, or if you have already read it, good on you, but in the next 2 to 3 weeks, read the textbook in its entirety, and then attempt some of those really old ones. Get a feel for how hard the questions are. I think you're going to be genuinely surprised at how hard they were. I certainly was. But yeah, it gives you a time to kind of attempt the past paper, get to grip with some of the concepts and how different the questions are in terms of needing to understand the concepts as opposed to know the concepts. And it gives you a bit of familiarity with how you should be answering questions in an actuarial exam.
With that, if you do find some of those old exam papers that are like pre-legic, then answering one post-legic and sharing that as a forum post could be a very useful way of sharing how would you answer this question now. So you might have the answer there to be able to do as a sample exam question, but it would be a very useful way of sharing the information and getting the new answer, if you like.
Mm. Yeah, that, just on that, 2B is a bit different just because Magic hasn't been around. Some of the questions relate to a previous capital requirements and capital standards, but that being said, that doesn't mean some of the concepts aren't relevant. You know, why you hold capital, what is capital used for, how do you, you know, increase or decrease your capital. You can still look at those questions and think about them in a Magic context, at least some of them you can. So yeah, and margin on services, which is the other big 2B thing, has been around since like 1996-ish, but something like that. So the actual exam. First thing, talk to people who have failed. I found this really helpful because they usually have really valuable insight. Right? Someone, because not only do they get the chance to talk about why they failed with an examiner, you know, you can pay a fee and you get a little interview, and it gives them insight into, okay, this was that actually what I needed to do differently. So I think that's really helpful. And one of the things I learned from that is that time management is really important, like super important. Because almost everyone I talked to said, oh, they ran out of time, or they didn't finish the question, or something like that. So if you struggle with time management, make sure this is something you practice, like practice in exam conditions, or you know, just think and make a plan for how you're going to approach the questions. Are you going to do the easiest first? How much time are you going to spend on the easiest and the hardest? You know, just think about it and have a plan and stick to it. I think that's the other thing that people struggle with when it comes to time management, is sticking to whatever plan that they come up with. Checking your work is particularly important now that you've got Excel-based exams. It's something you do at work, and maybe you're not going to spend as much time as checking as you do are going to do preparing, but simple basic checks that you can think of, like reconciliation items and stuff like that, are really helpful just to make sure that you're kind of confident. Or if you're not confident that you got it right, or you can see, oh, I've done a check, it's not right, what do? You can actually write, oh, this isn't right, I did a check, but this is as close as I'm going to get, sorry, you know? And they'll recognize that, okay, at least he recognizes the number's wrong, you know? That's a way to make sure that you don't lose all the marks, you get some, you know, and that's what it's about, getting some of the marks. So practicing creating spreadsheets that are readable, logical, and RFE, that's actually pretty good too. Just how will I make a decrement table, or how will I make projections of cash flows, right? One thing that I didn't do, but someone told me they did, is she would create these spreadsheets as a practice run, and then you can't take your spreadsheet into the exam, but she printed off the layout of the spreadsheet, so she knew when she made decrement tables, she needed to do this, this, this. And I thought that was a great idea, right? I wish I had done it, but I didn't. And the last thing is only put down the correct information. I know this has been said before, but if you do put down something illegal, not just illegal, but just straight up wrong, that's going to fail you as well, right? That's what, that's another thing I learned from people who have failed the exams before. Someone went in the exam, he did really well, like got all his marks, but he wrote something that was just wrong and he failed. You know? So it's not just illegal, it's also just straight up wrong. Foreign posts. They're free marks. I don't understand why there are people who have zero. I just don't get it. It's 10 free marks. That's 10% of the course. You know, it means you only have to get 50 as opposed to 60. So they're worth getting a start on early, right? Because original posts are really easy to make early on, but they're super hard later on because everyone's kind of cramming in at the end going, oh, I need to make another two, or I need to make another three. What am I going to write? And people write original posts at the end, and it's really sad because they've got zero responses. And I'm not sure they count as much if you've got zero responses. Right? One of the criteria is how well do you facilitate discussion or something like that. So it's important to put it early and get those original posts out of the way, and then you can respond to everyone else, you know, and help them out if they've got zero. I think I did 30 for both 2A and 2B. So I think Bruce told me 15, and I thought, oh, you know what, I'll just be safe and double it. Because, like, why not? You've got it's a way of studying as well that's a little bit easier. You can look at what other people have done, and I used to share them with people at work, and I'd be like, oh, hey, what do you think of this thing? And they said, oh, well, have you thought of this? And I'm like, oh, that's a good idea, and I'll write that. I also used to get ones from 2B and type in 2A and get ones from 2A. Sometimes there's a little bit of crossover. Just don't tell Bruce.
You do notice those.
Yeah, but, like, I mean, there's so much going on, right, in the news, just everywhere. Like, even just life insurance off the top of my head, you've got got acquisition or commentary on one path. You've got a participating business that's closed here, but it's really open in Asia, and they've got low interest rates over the region. Regulations are changing in Asia. How's that going to affect the way participating business is managed? You've got insurance and super working group. I don't know if people know about that, but that's pretty big. There's three forum posts right there. I'd be writing them down and going home and chucking them on straight away, right? Tons of stuff. There's tons of stuff in the news. I think every day there's something that you could be writing about. There's actually a website called www.insurancenews. That's a great website. So yeah, it's also a great source of information on current events, because that's where a lot of the questions come from, current events. Or at least sometimes you'll see a question in 2 years that might be about an acquisition, and that might reference something that's happening now. You know, it's a great way of keeping up to date with everything, because that's going to influence the way you think about questions, right? And if you start thinking about these concepts that are in the forum posts, you're going to be more ready to think about the concepts in the exam and apply them in the exam. So I think forum posts are a really great way to do it. And like I said, I read every single one. Really good. Is anyone doing CAP? So, and I guess there's people online, and I guess if you're doing it in a couple of years, you can just try and remember. They have orientation videos. It's a good idea to watch them early, definitely before the seminar or residential course or, you know, whatever it's called. Watch them now, just get a handle on it, and try to understand what they're talking about. It'll become a lot more clear in the residential course, and the residential course is really valuable. If you can stay near it, I recommend like you stay next to it, even if you live in the area, just because I think that makes it a little bit easier. What they talk about is contextualization, and it's really important. It's literally the only thing the course is about, right? They actually tell you why they have the CAT course in the CAT course. And the reason they have the CAT course is, I think it's a story that goes something like, the Institute surveyed a bunch of employers and said, what do you think about actuaries that have recently qualified? And they said something like, oh yeah, they're technically strong, they're really smart, but they're useless, right? And the reason they were useless was because something like they couldn't solve business issues, or they couldn't contextualize actuarial problems inside the entire business, right? So it's literally why they have the course, and it's the only thing it's about. So if you get it, I think that's how you do well at CAP. You just understand that concept, and if you don't get it, ask questions at the seminar. I mean, that's what it's there for. The people at the seminar are the people who are going to be marking your assignment and your exam, right? So get their opinion on contextualization. What does it mean when they talk about it, you know? Reading the questions carefully is really important, not just in CAP, but just in general. One word, you know, like if it's a big life insurer versus a small life insurer, that's going to change how you answer the question significantly, and that's one word. So think about how it might change if you, even if you're just looking at an old question, think about how it might change if you change six of the words. And you'll find that if you change the right words, it's going to completely change your answer. You know, big versus small has an impact on reinsurance, capital position, expenses, market distribution reach, like pretty much everything, right? That's a pretty, so keywords are really important. And in CAP, keywords affect business issues. Right, and it affects the actual advice, the actuarial advice you're going to give. So really important, contextualization and reading the question. With the assignment, you have days to read the question. Read the question tons of times and think about it. Take a day just to think about the question. Don't actually write anything. Think about what you're going to write and then write it. And I think that's true of the exam. You have 8 hours. It goes by quicker than you would think, but it's still 8 hours, right? It's like 7:55 if you have lunch. 7:55 is challenge because you kind of just run that now. I think CAP is difficult to study for because past papers take 8 hours, right? So having a buddy and critiquing each other's practice papers is a really good way to get advice. But as someone says, it's good to get other people's perspective on papers. And it doesn't have to be someone who's studying CAP, someone who's passed it already is also really helpful. And if you don't have time to do a whole past paper, and I thought it was 9, but apparently it's 8, just do the contextualization bit. Because like I said, that's all that matters. Yeah. Well, It's not the only thing that matters. But it's really, really important. So I think just doing that is still really good study. Yeah, that's pretty much all I got. If anyone has any questions about 2A, 2B, or ERM, I also did that. I know I didn't talk about it much, but I can also ask questions about that too. Yeah. Thank you. No.
All right, so when I first started my Part 3 journey, which is what I'm going to call it this whole time, one of the senior consultants at Rice Warner, which is where I work, took me aside, and he said he'd been doing the exam for years. Like, he's 40 now, and he's doing his last one. He took me aside, and he said, "Richard, I've seen thousands of analysts come and go. Some get through, some don't. And there's one correlating factor that determines who gets through and who doesn't. And it's not intelligence. It's how much they want it." And over the next 10 minutes, I'm going to try and explain why that's so important through how I experienced CAP. But a bit of background. So as I said, I work at Rice Warner at the moment. It's a superannuation consulting company. But I chose to specialize in investments. Why did I choose investments? First, because I'm interested in it. And secondly, but far more importantly, I chose it because it was the easy one and it had the higher pass rate. oops, wrong decision. I also joined in 2016 when the Institute cottoned on to the fact that a bunch of people weren't sitting ERM, they were sitting investments to replace ERM because it had a higher pass rate. Anyway, so we walked into the exam and I was faced with this. This is the first scene of Saving Private Ryan. I looked at the first question, 100 mark paper, 40 marks for the first question. I could understand 10 marks of them. That's not answer it, it's understand the words in the math. Needless to say, I failed that exam, absolutely, and so did 90% of other people. We went from a 67% pass rate to a 10% pass rate. What did I learn? Check your expectations at the door. I work with a guy called Anand, and Anand is exceptionally bright. He is fantastic, and he got the prize in 6A early last year. He failed last semester. Ditto with me. I got the prizes. I still failed. It's not correlated with intelligence. It's all about checking your expectations, and when there's a question that you see that absolutely blows your mind, and I guarantee you there will be a question that blows your mind, don't freak out. If you freak out, you've lost 100%. So anyway, I was a bit salty for probably 4 weeks. surprise. And then I started thinking, how was I going to do it? And I wasn't going to let this test beat me. So I went back in and re-enrolled straight away, and basically threw everything against the wall and decided I knew nothing. And so I started to work out what I was going to do. And three things kind of pulled forward. So this was round two. And those are my study notes for 5A and 5A. And that's just the textbook notes. I had past paper piles, yay wide. So first one, forum participation, it's already been touched on. I'm going to take it one step further than Grant, who said he doesn't understand why people get a zero. If my view is, and I tell my guys this at work, if you're getting anything less than 10 out of 10, you don't deserve to pass the course. It's free marks, the end. Second, coding models. Especially in investments, there are some really complicated models, especially in investment interest rates. I made that mistake the first time round. I skipped over because I didn't like interest rate models. Never make that mistake ever again. My view is that if you can't pull up Excel and from a blank Excel screen code me the model in question, and I mean every single model in question, you do not know that model well enough. It goes past the grammar test. It's at the Excel test now. The last one is past papers. It's been touched on, so I'll be fairly quick. This is another one about checking your expectations at the door. You are in a room of exceptionally bright people, like exceptionally bright. And you might think that doing all the past papers that the Institute of Actuaries gives you is sufficient. That's what I thought the first time round. I did all of the investment papers back to kind of yay 2005, and I thought that was good. No. So the second time around, I did every single paper back to 2005. Then I got the UK exams, and I went back to 97. Then I got the South African exams and went back to 2012. Now, you might think that this is really
going overboard, and I'm great at going overboard. But in my exam for 5B, questions 1A through 1F were almost verbatim from the UK 2015 exam. One of my friends sat the exam with me, and she says that's the only reason she passed. I'd recommend doing all the papers you can. Unfortunately, though, the Institute's a bit cheeky, and once you get really good at doing these quant-style exams, these technical exams, they decide to throw everything else at the wall and say, ha, you know nothing, you've got to do CAP. Now, CAP. The thing with CAP is that it's trained to basically teach you, as Brad said, to learn how to answer questions. Now, you might think native white Australian speaker, always spoken English, works in consulting, you'd think that I'd be really good at articulating responses. Wrong. Totally wrong. I will never forget Gaurav Kemka, who does the investments. He's fantastic. First words on the discussion forum to me. Richard, full stop. Very poor answer, full stop. Absolutely incoherent. Never again. So what you've got there is the forum post, and that's a screen cap of the last week before the exam. Now imagine what happens in the 15 weeks prior to the exam. The only way you get through CAP, and through arguably the rest of the actuarial part three session, is to really understand your place in this industry. It's not just you. It's you, your peers, and everything else. So first, you. Understand what your competitive advantage is. So for example, for me, my competitive advantage has never been numbers. For example, my year 10 math teacher told me that I wasn't good enough for 2 unit, and that if I did general math, I'd probably fail.
Oops.
But no, so I played at that. So in all of my exams, so my 5B, which is a quant exam, my exam paper was 5,000 words, because I typed the whole thing. I literally skipped every single math question that I couldn't do, because I was just like, I'm not going to ask that. Everyone else is going to do that? I'm going to do the other ones. And that played to my strengths. Second, your peers. Can I get everyone to look to the person to the left and then to the person to the right? These are the people who are going to be sitting in your exams with you. Now, I know that the deep down like feeling is that these are your enemies and you've got to beat them. I know because I had that feeling. These are your friends and they will get you through this. The forum posts are literally the greatest example of that. I literally downloaded every single person in investments executive summaries, and I literally cherry-picked the best items out of everyone's report. So if you look at my final script, it's effectively a cherry-pick of everything else that everyone else did. And then the last one is everything else. And the everything else is effectively anything you can do to get yourself over the line. For me, that was going out to other people for help. So Rice Warner's got really good senior consultants who are amazingly willing to talk to people. But it goes for your contacts as well. Grant and I, all the forum participators, I've never been said no to when I've asked for help if it was genuine. All of us will help you because we've all been there. So don't be afraid to ask for help. If there's something you don't understand, or if you just want general advice, literally just reach out and ask because no one's going to say no. So I suppose to conclude, I open the speech with the advice that my consultant gave me at the end. So it's all clear that you're super bright because you're here and you're like early and studying in week one, which I definitely didn't do until the second time around. You've all got the tools because we've tried to give you them. So then there's only one question that remains. And it's a question that I kind of want you to all take away and think about. If there's only one factor that determines what gets you through these terrible, terrible exams, my question to you is, how much do you want to pass? Because that will define everything else. So thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions? Awesome.
So that concludes the session for today. If we don't have any questions, we are just going to do a small presentation to say thank you, obviously, to our guests for their time and all their helpful hints and tips. I'll tell you the truth, I learned something from these guys today. And
which course are you going to study?
Which course not to study?
Yeah. pretty much. So I'll just ask all three
of you. Close. Is there any questions? We're happy to.
Yes. Are there any questions? Well, and for anyone online, you're welcome just to put your question down on the chat there, and we can give it to the examiners and the students here in the room. Does anyone have a question?
If the exam asks for like a memory or a coherent response, can we still do dot points?
Yes.
And how severely penalised or not would be?
What's your character required? Anyway, so my attitude always was that there was one mark or thereabouts for setting something up beautifully. And that my time wasn't worth that one mark, that I could earn the one mark somewhere else. And so my attitude was dot points was the best way to answer nearly every question, but that may not work for everybody.
I think that some questions are more suited to dot points. For example, if you're doing something like disadvantages or advantages, right? That makes a lot of sense to use dot points because some of the disadvantages will be quite quick or small or obvious. Some will be a bit more longer, and then you do a dot point, but the dot point is a little bit more fleshed out. You've got to remember you're in Word as well, so it's not going to be, like, it's still going to look okay when it's in dot points, if that makes sense. Yeah, and it's still going to be readable. So I think as long as the answer is readable and still makes sense, you can definitely use dot points, I'm pretty sure I did.
My view is that it's not an arts course. It doesn't matter if it doesn't look pretty, then you can still get those one mark. Opening line, yes sir. Second line, I have considered your points. These are my total theta. This is my theta. Dot point one, dot point two. How did you get that point?
And I think that would be fair to say that the CAP report full day exam one has more significance in the way you present and lay out than in the module 2A and 2B, which as Bruce says, in 2A and 2B, there may be a mark or two for it. It's more about if you're meant to write a memo discussing the advantages and disadvantages, and you only give dot points or advantages. That's the fact that you haven't answered the question rather than it's not in the memo format. That's the issue. You've got to cover what the question is asking. If you're asked to write a response to the CEO about this issue and the implications it has on capital, and you spend all your time talking about pricing, then again, you're not answering the question, even if it's dot points or memo. So, the memo structure in itself, no, but make sure you read the whole question and not just asking for a memo.
Dot points is one example of the issue of how much time do you spend on each question. And remembering that in order to pass, you have to get enough marks, and it doesn't matter where you get those marks from, as long as you get them in total across the three questions, but you also have to show the examiners that you are not a twit. It used to be called fitness to practice, that you are fit to be an actuary, but basically what it does mean is that there is no one question that you stuffed up. So if you can do this question and you're reasonably confident in doing it quickly, to get, you know, 80% of the marks you're capable of getting in 80% of the time, it's probably then time to say, okay, that one is above twit level. Time to move on and do the more difficult question, and I'll spend 110% of the time on that one because I know I have to get it above twit level. You turn me. So that, sure, you are trying to maximise mark, but you are also making sure that you have demonstrated that you are fit to practice. And when we say fit to practice, somebody else said earlier something to the effect of
if you've got six good points down and then your seventh one is a real clanker, then that's not a good idea. You don't throw those extra ones in. Fitness to practice means that the examiner, whoever it might be, is happy to have you standing beside them as a member of the profession that we love and value. Now, if you've missed one point, right, that probably doesn't make you unfit to practice, but if you dropped a clanker, that could be a problem, right? Picture yourself standing beside your boss presenting to a client. What does your boss expect of you? Your boss does not expect you to know everything that she knows. Your boss expects that you won't drop a clanker in front of the client. Right? That is far more important than that you came up with one more item.
It's sure, so it's not uncommon for a question out of 20 to have a potentially 25 or 26 marks. And for the average mark on that question to be 14 or 16 when you're marking. So it's quite possible that the examiner in asking the question has identified that there are more than just that many marks worth of answers. And so there's, you can only earn a maximum of 20 marks in this question, but there may be 26 in the marking guide when you actually look at the marking guide and what's listed in there. So don't think you always have to get 100% of them, and just aim at what you know and get it in there and move through, because you'll be surprised how big a difference that can make.
More questions?
Hey, this is a question then for Brandon and Richard, I guess. So going into CAP, did you guys sort of know what question you were going to do for the case study? Did you prepare both your module 1 PR and specialization and your main life one, or did you just pick one and just focus on one?
I picked one. I personally think but that's what I referred to. The other thing was my backup probably would have been ERM, and I was still studying it while I was doing CAP, so I didn't really have the ability to pick two, I think. But yeah, I picked one, and I think, honestly, that makes sense. Sure, you might get thrown a curveball, but if you're across it enough, like, you're still going to be able to get the business issue out of the question and answer it. There is a risk that maybe, yeah, the life one is harder than the other ones, but they do take that into account when they're marking, I think. I'm not 100% sure about that, but yeah. There we go. So, I did wonder.
So, when I went to the residential, I was planning to sit both Chris and Social Retirement System 1 and Persons. But I went to the Retirement System 1, and the guy who runs it there, I decided to read between the lines, because I've done it for a while. And I read between the lines to eventually conclude that they would ask you a DD question, so I actually threw Chris out. Didn't work out for me because they actually asked us to design a lifestyle investment product, which I'd done at work the week before. So that was definitely a unfortunate moment. But in terms of going forward, I would probably agree with Brent, focus on one and absolutely own it. If there is value to having a backup, but if you think you could, maybe you can, but I don't think you can do 100%. Investments will get everything from me. There was nothing worried about that exam. If you do that for two, just do that.
Yeah, and just to add to that, like, I mean, if you are dividing your attention between subjects, essentially half the attention you can to each topic. If you can do, you can certainly do more for one than
each marker marks differently. But I know they try to do it the same, but everyone has different idiosyncrasies. So people, like, you can really like for one thing and not care about it because it's not a marker. They try not to do that, but it's personal preference. So you learn to play to your market.
To struggle moderating between markets.
Yeah, just to add to that, that's another reason why the seminar is so valuable. You are talking to people who are going to mark the paper, or at least your assignment. They will express preferences when they're home. So, in fact, they even do it, then you get a sample copy of the group paper, right? If you just look at that one, that's an example of what they like for. Maybe model your assignment a little bit like that one. I certainly took that approach.
Well, I'm carefully. A piece of advice is take the assignment seriously. It's to a 20%, which is more than the 10% for the forum, but in CAP every semester, there are several people who fail the exam slightly, but pass overall because they had this assignment. Not every semester, but occasionally, including last semester, there are people who pass the exam and fail overall because their assignment is poor. For the other part three subjects, the impact of the forum is not so obvious because all the good students hopefully got 8, 9, or 10. And so it's not as big a or as obvious a determinant of who passes and fails at the margin. But the presumption is that you have got 8, 9, or 10.
And Bruce, having managed the forum for 2A last semester, actually predicted reasonably well one or two people who were borderline, which way they went, because his comments about their involvement in the forum. People who don't put the effort in there, you really struggle to find the marks or the reasons to say this person is capable of practicing a scholar, because they just haven't shown it, haven't demonstrated it. And there's only so much benefit of a doubt you feel comfortable giving before you sort of say, well, it's just too big a gap.
Two questions. The first one is, how did you go about asking for help, say, you weren't sure about something, like, say, for example, like asking, like, the senior actuary, they were pretty on board with, like, you asking questions? Look, definitely, I guess it depends on where you work and how much access you have to senior actuaries. I mean, at AIA, where I work, I'm not referring to that, there is a support system that's in place, but even if you go outside the support system, people are more than willing to help you. I think, as Richard said, everyone understands that these are difficult, and they've been where you've been, and they want to help you. Nobody really wants you to fail, right? Like, everyone wants you to pass, and they're willing to put the time in, or at least most of them are willing to put the time in. Or even if they're not, or they're a bit busy, they'll direct you to someone who can. The other alternative is put it in the forum, you know? Even if you don't fully understand it, someone else may work in that field or part of the industry and will have a really good grasp on it, you know? I work in group insurance, and a lot of people don't work in group insurance, and they would put questions about group insurance, and I was on that. I was like, this is what this is, and this is what that's about. And then when I have questions about retail, which I have a lot of, I would put them in that, and I would say, oh, I don't really get this, or how would this concept that's in group relate to retail, you know? So the forum and is still a great place, but if you can find senior actuaries, that's also really good. They're a goldmine. I mean, really great place. And if you work in a place that has access to all that, then I think they'd be pretty willing to help you.
Yeah, so although I'm really lucky. In terms of how you ask, honestly, I work on consultant with them, so I just kind of walked up half hours and I was like, hey, can I ask you a question really quick? And they're really a big tender to help now. Because they're really generous. That's all I can really say. Everyone's said it before, they're willing to help. There are a few examples. So I'm really careful not to go and read the flavors of all for a gap before I ask anything directly on CAP. But any of the sounding board for ideas, I can't put it to list how valuable it is.
Be prepared to sort of say, well, this is what I've looked at, or this is what I've read, or this is what I'm not. So you demonstrate the efforts you've made in asking the question. Otherwise, you might say, don't look in that, just point at a thing.
Yeah, they're not going to be able to help you if you haven't done anything. If you've tried to grasp the concept, then that helps. And the other thing is, if you set up time, you'd hope that you've done that. Yeah. If you set up time as well, that one helps. If you go, look, I want to grab you, you're working in this, and I don't get it. Can I set up some time with you so that we can just go through it for my exam? And then I'll be like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, just a double on that. So before my 5A exam, we haven't seen Tom Michael Bird, who is amazing at investments. And so probably 2 nights before my exam, I said I've already looked at him just to discuss potential going on the line. And between us, we came up with a question for it. might be why. So, and that was exceptional. So literally the night before, I wrote out my answer to 3A before the exam. Yeah, there was a little bit of a tweak to it because there was a chance that I hadn't seen them or not. But yeah, that was so interesting.
The interesting point is thinking about senior actuaries to ask. It's probably not necessary.
necessarily the most senior actuaries that you want to talk to, particularly in subjects like 2A and 3A, you are not being asked to tackle problems that the chief actuary of the big life company or the big general insurance company is tackling. You are being asked to tackle a problem that an actuary with 10 years experience or less is being asked to tackle. A junior actuary is the sort of problem that you are being asked to tackle. And so it is the more junior actuaries who can add a lot of value when you are asking them, hey, what have you been working on lately? What are the issues? Blah, blah, blah. Use everybody you can.
How do you tell if there's anything on the forum?
Also, could you just have a quick check on that? All right, well, it seems like we're done for today. For those of you online, thank you very much for joining us. And for those of you in the room, we do have some food and some drinks, and obviously the opportunity to still talk to the others and get to know each other. And we hope you'll stick around for that. Thank you very much for your time here. And we look forward to supporting you this semester.